You're listening to The Digital Show on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here again is Professor Kevin Werbach.
So welcome back, everyone, to The Digital Show. As a reminder, once again, we'd love to hear your thoughts and comments for any of our guests. Give us a call at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. My next guest is Maurice Stuckey, an expert on competition policy. He's a co-founder of the law firm The Concurrence Group and a law professor at the University of Tennessee, author of several works, including co-author of a recent book called Virtual Competition, which makes some fascinating arguments about the rise of digital platforms and algorithmic systems and their implications for competition. So delighted to have him on the show. So, Maurice, thank you for joining us on The Digital Show.
Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. So, so you've made the argument in a number of places that some of this new technology, which it seems at first would open up opportunities for new kinds of competition, is actually leading to more concentration. So can you sketch out broadly what you see happening? And then I'd love to drill down to some more of the specifics.
Sure. So there are really two tracks. One track is, what are the implications of a data-driven economy on antitrust? You know, are the antitrust tools that we have currently, are they adequate to deal with potential issues that may arise in the data-driven economy? And then the second is, the data-driven economy would appear on many levels to be pro-competitive, and in some ways it can be pro-competitive, but can we necessarily assume that it will always be pro-competitive? And here in virtual competition, we raise several potential risks that a data-driven economy can raise.
Okay, so let's take those each in sequence then. So what's the scope of antitrust and where does it fall down in terms of dealing with some of these new kinds of companies and services?
Okay, so the first deals with, you know, you really have to look backwards and look forwards. And looking backwards over the past 30 years, has antitrust gotten it right? And what we've developed is so-called light antitrust. And this was heavily influenced by the University of Chicago and the post-Chicago schools, which to various degrees have argued that markets are often self-correcting, that entry barriers are low, and they're really requires only a light touch by the antitrust enforcers, because very often markets will self-correct and the government can often do greater harm than good. And what we've seen over the past 35 years is the unfolding of this light touch antitrust, and particularly with very little enforcement involving monopolies. In fact, there's been only one enforcement action by the DOJ in the past 16 years. So one thing is, has the DOJ and the FTC gotten it right with respect to price competition over the past 30 years? And what you've seen over the last year by the Council of Economic Advisers, among others, is that the state of competition may not be as healthy as we may assume. That in fact, that you're seeing growing concentration in many industries, profits are accruing to a handful of firms, there's less labor mobility and the like. So with respect to light antitrust, it's unclear whether or not we've been on the right track. Then the question is, going forward, are the antitrust tools that we have sufficient to deal with these issues? And data-driven industries raise several problems for antitrust enforcers. One problem is that antitrust has developed very sophisticated tools to assess price competition. And this goes back to what Hayek, when he won the Nobel Prize, mentioned, is that in many sciences, what's measurable is often what's important. But we can't always assume that in economics. And price may not necessarily be the most important parameter of competition going forward. And what's measurable may not necessarily be what's important when we look at these economies. And this is particularly true with the data-driven industries, where products and services are often offered for free. And the antitrust tools for dealing with free goods and services are very crude. So that then suggests, you know, if the tools weren't great for price competition, can we be assured that they're going to be adequate for non-price competition? And there are several other challenges that data-driven mergers and data-driven economies pose for antitrust, but that's just one of them.
Right, and some of these are not new issues. I mean, a lot of these kinds of questions came up 20-plus years ago in the Microsoft antitrust trial, where Microsoft, you know, very forcefully made the argument, you know, look, Windows is incredibly cheap for what goes into it. And, you know, at that point, obviously, the Justice Department was able to convince the court that they had engaged in antitrust violations. But it was very difficult even then to kind of work through these issues. So what's changed since that time?
Yeah, Microsoft was interesting because I was actually working at Sullivan & Cromwell at the time and had a small bit in the Microsoft matter. The court there grappled with, is antitrust relevant in emerging dynamic markets? And the D.C. Circuit ultimately concluded, yes, that antitrust still has a role to play. Data-driven economies, though, accelerate many of the things that we saw in Microsoft. And so one thing in Microsoft were these network effects. And what happens then is as more people use a particular software program, the more that attracts other developers. Like the more people that use this particular operating system, the more people that would write then software for that operating system. And so it can have this positive feedback effect. What we see now with these data-driven economies is that not only is there just that one type of network effect, there are three other types of network effects. And these network effects can have the impact of making the strong even stronger.
What are those network effects?
So one network effect deals with what we call learning by doing. And here it's the data can help train the algorithm to become smarter, and it actually affects the quality of the product itself. So one example would be search engines. That if you have very few people that use your search engines, the search engine algorithm has fewer trial by error opportunities, and the quality of it will not be necessarily that great. But the more people that use the search engine, the more that the search engine can then say, all right, did I accurately predict what your preferences would be in terms of relevant search responses? And then it can tailor and learn as a result and improve. And the more people that use the search engine, the better the search engine can be in identifying then relevant responses, and the more people then that could be attracted to that search engine. And this is not only with respect to search engines. It could be facial recognition, like with Facebook. The more photographs it has, the more it can train its algorithm, the better the algorithm can be. That's one network effect. Another one is not only the scale of the data, but also the scope of the data. And so now if Facebook, for example, they want to come up with this digital assistant, as you know, Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Amazon, the greater the variety of data that they have about you, the better they can predict your wants, your needs, and the like. So now imagine it's no longer just a search engine per se, but it's a personalized search engine. So it can accurately identify what you want. And so having greater data about your personal life, whether, you know, what's on your email, what's on your calendar, your geolocation data, and the like, the better it can predict relevant things for you in particular. And so that would be then the third network effect. And the fourth network effect, and this has been a traditional one, and we call it the spillover network effect, is the more that's on one side of the platform, the more it attracts on the other side of the platform. Mm-hmm. So for search engines, the more people that use a particular search engine, the more attractive it is for advertisers to try to reach that. And that's a traditional network effect. But the data here can really accentuate that network effect. And we use in our book an example of coupons.com. So the more data that they have on consumers, the better they can predict the price sensitivity of consumers, the more that they can predict what coupons that user might be interested in. And that then attracts then people like the manufacturers that have the coupons to provide those coupons. So you can see here data comes with a vengeance in accentuating these network effects.
So all of those are reasons why in this kind of data-driven world, the rich get richer, if you will, that the very big companies have a stronger position. But they're also reasons that they can serve their customers better and give them more of what they want. So, you know, how should antitrust and competition policy think about that and not you know, kill the golden goose by trying to break up some of these monopolies in a way that actually hurts consumers?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point. I mean, one of the things about the network effects is that your utility increases as other people use that service. So we're not arguing that network effects are per se bad. In fact, they can be good. You may not think necessarily other people using Google can improve the value of Google to you, but it can. And so the competition agencies will not strike at someone from using these from benefiting from these network effects. But there are really two important points that these network effects can inform antitrust analysis. First is that the stakes are a lot greater. So, for example, if you use Colgate versus Crest, it's not going to affect the quality of the product per se. That, you know, Colgate might get some extra profits, Crest might lose, but the quality of the toothpaste is the same. With these network effects, as more people use a particular search engine or use a digital personal assistant or the like, the quality of the product itself can change. So the stakes are a lot greater. The second thing is, given that the stakes are a lot greater, the incentives to engage in anti-competitive behavior to tip the market to favor them also increase. So the problem is not necessarily the network effects per se. It could be the incentives then of companies to engage in tactics to tip the market to their advantage that aren't then competition on the merits.
Right, and that's one of the interesting points that you make in the book is describing some of these potentially new kinds of strategies or anti-competitive tactics that are possible in this more algorithmic world. So can you talk about some of what's changed in terms of what opportunities companies now have that they might not have before?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that differs the current monopoly from the Microsoft monopoly is what we call the now casting radar. And I think an analyst from Wall Street said it really well, that apps are worth millions, but platforms are worth billions. Hmm. And one advantage that a platform can have is this now casting radar. And Google is, for example, was famous for being able to predict flu trends before the government had the data by looking at what the search queries were. Now, there there were problems with that because sometimes people might search something without necessarily having the flu. But you can see through the searches emerging trends, and that can alert the company as to not only the flu, but real estate trends and the like. And that can give them a significant competitive advantage. Another thing is by controlling the underlying platform, you also can see where your users are going and what apps they're downloading and the like. And that gives you an inside view to see if there's any potential threat. So Microsoft couldn't necessarily see, you know, how many people were necessarily downloading Netscape at the time back in the 1990s. But now a company like Google or Apple can see, you know, what other apps they're downloading and to what extent those apps might pose a potential threat. And then they can take actions like either acquire the company or they can make it harder for users to use that app.
And you know, what about potential for, you know, for collusion or ways that companies can then work together in this kind of environment?
Right. So that takes us now to our book, Virtual Competition.
Right.
And it was really fascinating. We were on our way to lunch. And I was at Oxford with Mike Ariel Ezraki, and we just started up this conversation. We noticed like the migration towards these pricing algorithms and how companies like Amazon are increasingly relying on these pricing algorithms. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, what would happen if computers colluded? What if these pricing algorithms agreed among themselves to a cartel? And that was just a very rough way of thinking about it. And what we then came about were four scenarios where algorithms can help perfect collusion. And on the one hand, you could say, well, algorithms can actually undermine collusion, because what the DOJ have found is that a lot of these cartels are very durable. And the reason that they're durable, more so than what neoclassical economic theory would posit, is that people are trusting. And that they find, ironically rather, that the cartel members entrusting one another can make these cartels much more durable than what you would otherwise expect. And this includes meeting, getting to trust one another, and developing the cartel to become quite resilient over time. With these algorithms, there is no trust. There's no human emotion necessarily. And you would expect then that any sort of cartel would be less likely as a result. But what we found is that you might have a new type of collusion that might emerge. So the easiest way to think about this issue is the messenger scenario, whereby the humans collude and then they use the algorithms to help perfect their collusion. And this case already happened. It was as we were finishing our first article, the Topkins case was decided. And there, the DOJ prosecuted this person who, with his co-conspirators, were using algorithms to help maintain their cartel. So they agreed to fix the price of posters sold on Amazon, and they used these algorithms to help monitor the price and to ensure that everyone was sticking to the price.
So how does the algorithm actually do that?
What it does then is the algorithm can quickly monitor what others are charging and then readily adjust it to the agreed-upon formula that they would then employ. So here the humans agree. Let's say we're going to agree that the price will be X plus, let's say, 10%, and let's say there might be a maverick or something. If the maverick comes in, they then agree to abandon it or the like. So they can then agree to the terms of the cartel and then use the algorithm to help monitor that everyone is actually agreeing to the, charging the agreed-upon price. And then there might be some punishment mechanism that they can then say, all right, if anyone deviates, we're going to punish that person by then undercutting them by X percent. And this way it provides a commitment device, because now you then agree to the cartel, you then have the algorithm then monitor all your compatriots, and everyone can be assured that no one is going to be cheating and colluding as cheating from the cartel.
Yeah, I think it's been fascinating to watch the growth of all of these algorithmic pricing systems. I think most people still are unaware when they go to Amazon or any of these other kinds of sites how much the prices do fluctuate based on a variety of different reasons, but certainly automated in some way technologically. That though seems to be a kind of classic scenario where you can the algorithm makes it more possible to engage in collusion, but there's no real antitrust question that kind of collusion is a problem, right?
Right. That's the no-brainer. So that's the first and the simplest scenario, because here the illegality inheres with the agreement itself. And so the humans agree. They use the algorithm to perfect their cartel. The humans in the United States go to jail. So that's pretty straightforward. The second scenario is a little bit more problematic. And here we call it the hub and spoke. And we use the example of an Office Depot or Staples or the like. And let's say they realize that they've got all these products, and to gain a competitive advantage to compete against Amazon, they're going to, let's say, use a algorithm to set the price for their products. And they outsource it to a third party, let's say Boomerang. And Boomerang then gives them the opportunity to engage in dynamic pricing. So that's not an anti-competitive problem. But what if now Staples' competitor, let's say Office Depot or Office Max, or anyone else, I mean, assuming that they are still in existence at this time, and they agree also to use the same third-party vendor to determine the price. So now you have a series of competitors that are all using the same third party to determine what the price of their goods or services might be. And here you can then have what then resembles a hub and spoke cartel, where the hub is the third party, let's say Boomerang, and the spokes are the various rivals that are then using it. And another example we use is Uber, which has these various drivers, and they're arguably could be competing with one another over price, but they all agree to use Uber and Uber's algorithm to determine then what the price of the ride will be, including any surcharge. And it's not problematic when the first person uses the hub. The problem is what happens then when the third, fourth, fifth, sixth competitor starts using the same hub to determine the pricing. You can then have the effect of the cartel that we identified earlier.
Right, and the Uber one is kind of the sort of ironic effect that Uber's argument is that these drivers aren't its employees, and therefore if they're independent contractors, then in theory they could set their own prices, but in practice they don't.
Right, and the problem is with this is like when Uber comes into the market and the first driver agrees to use Uber, there's no anti-competitive problem, nor is there necessarily an anti-competitive problem when the second or third driver joins the Uber platform. The problem is what happens once Uber starts getting a lot of market power, that it becomes the dominant ride-sharing app in a particular market. Rather than responding to market forces, it's actually determining the market price. And then the question then is, what then is the check on Uber? So let's say if they dominate a particular market, and let's say taxis and Lyft and other services are relatively weak, then every driver that joins the Uber platform can be assured that no one else will undercut them on price, and you can have the effect then of a cartel.
So I know there's a number of other pieces, scenarios that you work through in the book. We've only got a couple more minutes, so I wanted to just focus a little bit towards the end on what are the solutions, or what kinds of tools could antitrust authorities have to address some of these kinds of problems that you're articulating?
One thing is to understand, do they have the tools to address these problems? For some of them, they do, but for others, they don't. In particular, when we look at collusion, when there is the effect of tacit collusion, where everyone is interdependent and they're looking at each other's price, but there's no agreement, then we don't really have any legal solution to this. We have a problem, but not necessarily a resolution under the antitrust laws. So that might require then additional tools for the antitrust enforcer. For others, they have the statutory basis, but they just don't have the tools themselves. And this would be, how do you assess a merger's impact on non-price competition, in particular privacy protection? Mm-hmm. There, the antitrust law covers the harm. But the tools that the agencies use aren't very good, so it requires refining those tools. And then a third is the ability to say, what don't they know? The antitrust officials make a lot of predictions about mergers, but very rarely do they go back and actually assess, did we get our prediction right? And what the available literature that we have out there on price effects is that the antitrust agencies often get it wrong. Now, there are problems with these post-merger reviews, and you can have like selection bias and the like. But nonetheless, looking at that and looking at the macro trends, it might suggest that the antitrust enforcers aren't necessarily getting it right often in predicting these mega mergers. So do the tools that they have for price competition need to be revised? And do they need to develop better tools for assessing non-price competition?
Yeah, and it seems like, though, I mean, not just necessarily for the antitrust enforcement authorities, but more broadly, there's such a rhetoric that these new technologies and new companies are inherently pro-competitive, and they're, you know, they're disruptive innovators, and it's only the incumbents that are the, you know, the ones standing in the way of competition. I think, you know, we're starting to hear a lot of pushback on companies like Uber as they get so big and so powerful, even though they're, you know, still private companies. But do you think that perception is going to shift, where there's going to be more concern overall about the anti-competitive effects?
Yes, you're starting to see that already in Europe. And I think what this is going to require for the next administration, the incoming administration, is strong intellectual leadership, that they have to be able to say, all right, are we getting it right? And how do we know we're getting it right? And if we're not getting it right, what can we do to start getting it right? There's been this sort of like smugness that within the antitrust community that, you know, we've got these very sophisticated tools, we know what we're doing, just leave us alone, like this sort of technocracy. But I think what you're starting to get now is questioning about, well, that may not be the case. And the fact that you're not getting it right up to this point, how can you be assured you're going to get it right going forward, where your tools may not even work to tackle some of these issues in the data-driven economy? You just can't rely on the assumption that these markets are self-correcting, they're dynamic, and consumers will always benefit. Because I think what both of our books, Big Data Competition Policy and Virtual Competition, point out is that consumers don't always benefit. And you also have a potential upstream effect on a lot of people that supply goods and services to these platforms, and they could have adverse effects on them. These could include like photojournalists, newspaper journalists, authors, musicians, and the like, whose goods and services are being used by the super platform to attract consumers.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I really appreciate, Maurice Stuckey, your coming on the show and talking with us. These are tremendously important issues and fascinating new scenarios coming about. And so, again, thank you for joining us on the show. Again, the book is Virtual Competition. And what was there's a second book that you also co-author that was Big Data and Competition, or?
Big Data and Competition Policy by Oxford University Press.
Great. So thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much.
We will take one more break after this. And then when I come back, my final guest will be Brian Bellendorf, Executive Director of the Hyperledger Project. Once again, we welcome your thoughts and calls here on The Digital Show on Sirius XM Business Radio. So stick around, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.